dark out. But
it is actually the longest night of the year, since it's December 21st, so I will try not to make it the longest night of the year for you. That's probably okay. Let's see if it'll come off in a minute. So what I decided, it's not centered, right?
No, it's not.
Okay. You know,
can we move this more?
You know what? If we shut this and then bring the screen down, maybe that will do.
Okay.
Let's try that. Don't ask me why the rooms are designed. It's not centered, but. Okay. Now let's try the screen. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, donuts to eat and dreidel to play, so thanks for coming. I appreciate it. What I decided to do tonight is actually, everybody knows kind of the Hanukkah story, so I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you know, the basics, the things that you learn from, you know, if you're like my kids, you say, oh, we learn the same thing year after year after year, right? So, but what I want to do actually is give you the preamble, is give you the backstory of how did we get to the position that you had Seleucids and you had Jews kind of, you know, trying to define themselves and fighting with each other. How do we get there? Okay, so that's where, and in order to tell that story, and I have this fancy new device here. Let's see if it works with this. Oh, it doesn't because I'm not using the slide. All right, so I'm gonna have to just do this. Oh. So the story really begins. We have to go back to Alexander the Great, okay? So Alexander the Great, he defeated Darius III, who was the Persian emperor, the Persian king, who at the time, that was the other big, you know, sort of superpower of the day. Beside, this is what you see here. Oh, well, this way you're not gonna get to see my cool slides where things come out. But this is the famous Battle of Issus behind it. We move this. Can see this is Darius right here. I mean, this is Alexander confronting Darius, and here's the close-up of Alexander. It's kind of a famous picture. It's probably most books on Alexander the Great will include that picture. Anyway, when this happened in the year 333, the Jews, particularly the Jews in Jerusalem, but the Jews throughout the entire world, were shocked. And Jews were, for the most part, the Jews were very loyal subjects to Persia. I mean, Persia had been very good to the Jews, right? Cyrus had, when he conquered the Babylonians, he issued that famous edict that let the Jews return, and he supported their efforts to go back and to build their temple. And so for 200 years, the Jews had lived as loyal, relatively happy. You know, they didn't have complete political independence, but they had religious autonomy, and for the most part, they were pretty satisfied with that. And in fact, Josephus, the first century historian, tells us that the Kohen Gadol refused at first to submit to Alexander because he had taken a vow to remain loyal to the last Persian king. But as a result of a dream, capitulated when Alexander promised that throughout the empire the Jews would continue to be governed according to their own law, which is really was the great concern of the Jews, which was up to that point with the Persians, they had reached an accommodation which will be put in place for the next over 2,000 years, more or less, which is that the Jews will be loyal subjects, or at least they'll pay their taxes, and in return, they will have religious autonomy, meaning they can control their religious destiny. And so that was a concern with Alexander. Would he let them continue that? Or, you know, they didn't know. Or would he force them to be something else? Okay, so he said that. So at first then, this Macedonian conquest really didn't make much of a difference in the life of the Jews. The Torah continued to be the official law of Judah. And yet the legend of Alexander's dealings with the Kohen Gadol was significant because it illustrated sort of this complexity that Jews are gonna have vis-a-vis Hellenism, vis-a-vis the Greeks. Some Jews recoiled, I feel like the lights are going up and down here.
Yeah.
Some Jews recoiled distinctively from the culture of the Greeks and wanted to just cling to the way things had been, while others kind of were intrigued by this new culture and were a little more open-minded towards it, even beyond just the curious. And so basically the struggle between those opposing factions will now dominate the history of the Jews, particularly in Judah, for the next 300 years. So basically Hellenism had actually been gradually penetrating the ancient Near East, of which Judah was part of, before Alexander, meaning there had been trade with Greece from the coast, and it was mostly the Phoenicians along the coast that were involved in this trade. And Judah, which was a little more isolated, kind of landlocked, those influences reached them kind of, a few generations later. There was sort of a cultural lag between what was going on the coast and what was reaching Judah. But overall, then, I would say the Jews really didn't have any direct contact with the Greeks. It would have been more of the Phoenicians who were on the coast that would have had the contact. And whatever contact they did have with Greek culture, it was being mediated by the Phoenicians and then passing on to Judah. So anyway, all of that changed when Alexander died. He died in 323. Could be mysterious circumstances, we don't know. But as a result of his death, there really wasn't a suitable heir who could hold the empire together. And so what happens is his empire gets divided up. And so for the next two decades, really, it doesn't get divided up simply. For the next two decades, the lands conquered by Alexander were sort of convulsed by battles of people competing to see who would succeed him. And Judah, or this Persian province of Yehud, was sort of an important transit in the region. Remember, going between Egypt and between Syria. And so it was constantly being invaded by armies on the march from either Turkey or Syria down into Egypt, back and forth. So, for the next 20 years, there was probably not a month that went by without an army marching through Judah with their baggage, their equipment, their families, their slaves, whatever it was, marching through. And in fact, Jerusalem itself was conquered no fewer than 6 times during this 20 years, changing hands. And so the inhabitants of Jerusalem sort of became painfully aware that their sort of peaceful isolation had come to an end here. And so the Jews of Jerusalem, basically, their first experience, direct exposure to Hellenism was as a very destructive force. Right, it was with all of these armies that were going through. It was violent and it was militaristic. And then in the year 301, so that's already 30 years after Alexander, over 20 years after he died, Judah, which now it's going to be, you'll see the name is changing to Judea, but Judea, the area around Shomron, the Samaria, Phoenicia, the whole coastal plain was captured by Ptolemy first, okay? And he had set up shop in Egypt. So the Ptolemies, who were living in Egypt and ruling from Egypt, managed to gain control over basically the entire greater land of Israel, and that was sort of at the expense of the Seleucids, who were living, their seat was in Damascus. Okay, so first Israel, the land of Israel, Jerusalem, Judah, comes under the domain of the Ptolemies. And for the next 100 years, Jerusalem will remain under the Ptolemies, who basically wanted the land of Israel for a couple things. One was the Phoenician ports were very profitable, so they wanted that tax revenue. They wanted to keep the trade routes open, and also they wanted it as a buffer against Syria, because Since their base was in Egypt, the last thing they wanted were the Seleucid right there on their border between Egypt. So the land of Israel kind of gave them a buffer against Syria. Okay, like most ancient rulers, the Ptolemies didn't interfere very much. Let me just go to this slide here. You can see the one on the top is all of Alexander's empire. And then you'll see how it gets divided up ultimately. What's going to be important for our story here is this area around Egypt is controlled by the Ptolemies and their family. And then this is the Seleucids. This is Seleucids right here at the beginning. And then they'll spread down. Okay? So you have the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Okay, but like most ancient rulers, the Ptolemies did not interfere that much with local affairs. Meaning they didn't want to get involved in the day-to-day running of life in Judah or in Jerusalem. What they really wanted was just to make sure that Judah, Jerusalem wasn't causing any troubles and that they were paying their taxes, right? That as long as you're doing that, they pretty much left them alone. They did introduce some efficiencies, and we have the archaeological records of certain tax receipts that show that the Ptolemies actually introduced certain efficiencies that made it easier for them to collect taxes. Kind of they redivided up some of the way that the land was redistributed, but other than that, they didn't get too involved. But they did introduce, sort of indirectly, some new concepts to the people. The first was, Hellenistic culture, which was a secular culture. The second concept that gets introduced, the idea of it, is the concept of a polis. Okay, a polis, these are secular cities, meaning in Greek culture, one of the distinguishing features of it was that there really was a separation between church and state, between the temple and the state. So here, I don't know how easy that is for you to see, but this actually is just a family tree of the Ptolemies, and you'll be familiar, I would imagine, with this one, with this famous lady right here. Can you read it? Cleopatra, right? She had children both with Julius Caesar and with Mark Antony. And so she was a descendant. The Ptolemies, even though if you look at them here, what do they look like? They look very Egyptian, right? So that's what we call sort of going native. You know, when you come to a new country and after a little while you sort of go native and you kind of take on all the traffic. And so that's what they did. The Ptolemies, they were Greeks, okay? But they took on the trappings of Egyptian pharaohs because that was, well, first of all, it's probably fun, right? I mean, who wouldn't want a headdress like that? Actually, my son has one for Purim time, and it's great. You can't really get any better than that. I mean, once you have that.
He's not with the Ramadan.
Huh? Oh, right, he should be wearing it for Hanukkah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. He's wearing it before. All right, he's confused. He's one of those fake beards. Yeah.
What's that thing called?
I just called it a headdress. And then they also had these false beards. So even Cleopatra, I don't know about her, but other queens, like Hatshepsut, if you go to the Met Museum in New York, you know, at 82nd and 5th Avenue, if you ever leave Stern, you could go on there. So even when there's a female pharaoh, because the concept of pharaoh is a male concept, she is shown with the fake beard. And they do show, her figure's a little more slender. She's not as buff as the other ones to show that she's a woman. But yet the pharaoh was a masculine, it was a masculine concept. So anyway, so they went native. But just so that you know, these are all Greeks. They're ruling in Egypt, but they're not descended from the Egyptian pharaohs. All right, let's see, what's the next one? Okay, yeah. So a Greek polis. Now, this was one way that Greek culture spread. Yeah?
Sorry, what was the other concept that you said that they introduced besides for Hellenism?
Oh, so I'm getting the polis.
Okay.
Which is, here I put a definition up. Here it's, we can just read it. No matter how large or small, all Greek cities shared certain common public buildings. Civic life was centered in and around these structures. A few of the more important included the Acropolis. I'll show you. These will be familiar to you. the Agora, which was the marketplace, the Bulaterion, which was the Council of Citizens, a gymnasium, familiar with that, a temple, and a theater. There were other elements too, but these were kind of the basic ones. And so this was kind of how, this was how Greek culture spread, was that kind of city by city, these institutions would pop up, and then around, then the communal life of the city would revolve around them. So you see how it wasn't as if the Greeks were forcing this down people's throats. I mean, most people enjoyed these aspects. These were nice aspects to urban life that was desirable. But this was how the culture then spread. And keep this in mind, because Jerusalem originally, well, actually throughout the period, it will never actually have the status of a polis. It's a status, sort of, even in the United States, the government will define a city a certain way, and I think if you fall below a million people, you're not eligible for certain tax things or whatever. So we have definitions too, although we don't pay any attention to them. Unless you dip below and then you don't get the tax revenue, then of course you pay attention to it. But so the polis was a whole package. And it also gave you certain benefits as a citizen. So they introduced this concept. And the polis, though, was ultimately very secular. I mean, there was a temple in it, but other aspects of city life were not. It wasn't. So, Judah was basically still very much of a, the religion was intertwined into all aspects of life. But in the Greek world, it wasn't. Okay. Another new concept that will have ramifications, particularly for Jerusalem, is the gymnasium. So we tend. So what do you think of when you think of a gymnasium?
A Greek gymnasium or a regular gymnasium in our time?
Okay. Well, let's start with both. What about a regular one in our time?
Well, they see treadmills.
Okay. Or JCC that maybe has a little bit more than exercise, right? But okay, and what about in ancient times?
Lots of people competing naked.
That seems really like, if you don't know anything else about gymnasium, right? Everybody remembers that, right?
Is it a lot of times like a school?
Huh?
Isn't it a lot of times gymnasium like a school?
Yes, absolutely. And that gets, again, back to the Greek ideal that didn't separate between the body and the mind. And no, you didn't go to school naked, okay? So just, I saw the question as, right there. So actually the gymnasium was contributed to the society because it, besides being fun to go to, but really what it was a school where the young people were educated. Okay, so how do Greek boys grow up to be Greek men? Well, the way they grew up to become Greeks is because by going to the gymnasium, they would then engage, they would be trained according to sort of the Hellenistic ideal. So they would study Greek literature, and then of course they underwent rigorous military training. So they were developing their mind and their body simultaneously. Okay, and this was an institution in the same way that we sort of in the United States, right, where there's lots and lots of colleges all across, and they compete against each other in sports, and the Stern football team plays sometimes Ohio State, but the idea was that it was an institution then, the gymnasium, that would link up Greeks throughout the entire empire. They could, just like today, when people say, what school do you go to? I'm sure back then people say, what gymnasium do you go to, whatever, and they would discuss that. So at first, well, let me just show you some of these elements, and then maybe we can even do away with these slides. So here was the Acropolis. Like a typical Greek city would have sort of the fortress at the high point of the city, and could often offer the point of the Acropolis. A lot of times it would be fortified separately, and that could offer some kind of refuge in, both internally from internal enemies, like people in your own city want to kill you, you can run there, and also from external enemies. All right, let's just see what other. Another thing here is showing you the marketplaces. All cities would have these kinds of marketplaces, and that were not just for. I mean, the marketplace obviously was the center for commercial activity,
The building would be called the Stoa, and you can see it here. In fact, you know, when Herod redesigns the Second Temple, where today the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, that was the area where the royal Stoa had been, which was the central market feature. And let's see, here, this is the last slide, maybe, and then we can just turn it back on the lights. Here you can see theaters, right? They were like that. And here's an example of a temple. And here's sort of an artist reconstruction of what a gymnasium looked like. I think that's it for the slides. And then, okay, so why don't we turn back on the lights? And then we can not pay attention to that. It's kind of off-center. Okay. So anyway, at first, Jerusalem was not too affected by this, because it was not a polis. So, you know, by definition, it didn't have all of these essential elements in it. Therefore, it had no gymnasium. And the Torah continued to be the law of the land. And probably at this early time, I would say, you know, around the year 300, I would guess that most of the Jews of Judah would have been pretty horrified at the idea of, like, competing, you know, in the nude. But eventually, one final point is Judah, of course, wasn't any great, or Judea, it wasn't any great asset to the Ptolemies either. They, for the most part, they left it alone. Their chief link, then, was they would receive 20 talents of silver each year from this, you know, province here. Okay, inevitably, though, that situation that's been described at the very beginning isn't going to last. And eventually the Jews would be dragged into the Greek world. And by the end of the 3rd century then, so by 100 years later, some Jews had begun to acquire the rudiments of Greek, of a Greek education, and were even giving their children Greek names. That's one way to see, it's not 100%, but one way, one indication, I would say, of sort of, you know, where people are culturally is people will look and study their names. So for example, you know, if your name happened to have, say, Baal in it, well then, you know, that's not a very Jewish name, because you've got the name of the Canaanite god in it. So we would assume either you were a very assimilated Jew, or you were not really, you were probably a Canaanite. So the Jews start taking on some Greek names. And there's one family in particular that becomes closely linked to the Greeks, and that's the Tobiad clan, the Tobiad family. And they were closely associated with the Ptolemies. In fact, there was a Joseph Tobiad, who was the chief tax collector. So I guess we could say he is given credit as the first Jewish banker ever. So some Jews then were gravitating towards Greek culture. On the other hand, there were those who were more conservative and those who found it very threatening. In particular, the lower classes who were not participating in what was overall a time of prosperity. Meaning that, you know, with the Greeks, and there wasn't any wars, after those 20 years of wars, things kind of settled down, and so the general economy seems to pick up, and there is a sense of general prosperity. These conservative Jews, that, I mean, using conservative, not in any kind of political sense, and certainly not like referring to conservative Jews, but they tend to be more conservative, they sort of found themselves kind of drawn more to, the Kohanim, to the priestly class in Jerusalem, which their leader were then the Onaites, okay, from Onias, which was a priestly family that were supposed to be descended from Tzadok, and so that's how they're known as the Tzadokim, or in English they call them the Sadducees. But this was considered the highest level priestly family, and in fact the Kohen Gadol was supposed to come from this line, okay? We'll see that it gets violated, but they were considered to have the best lineage. And so you had sort of the Tobiads, who were supporters of Ptolemy and had a very cozy relationship. They were the tax collectors. And then you had this other group sort of centered around the priests, who were the Onaids, And of course, if the Tobiahs are supporters of the Ptolemies, guess where you think the Oneids, they're going to throw their weight with the Seleucids. So they're going to sort of, so what happens is these internal divisions between the Jewish communities then sort of gets played out on a larger scene. The Oneids themselves were attracted to the Greek ideal. It doesn't mean that they totally rejected it. In fact, many of them also had Greek names, but they were very closely tied to the Beit HaMikdash. And so they wanted to make, you know, they were very meticulous, punctilious in its observance, and the sacrifices always continued uninterrupted. So they were determined to maintain these old laws and traditions, and, you know, partly it could have been out of piety, but also remember, they're the Kohanim, so they have a vested interest in keeping the system going because they're the ones who are benefiting from it, right? Okay, so towards the end of the 3rd century, though, so we're talking around the around the year 200, what happens is that the Seleucids finally gain more power, and they actually conquer the whole country. So they take over these lands that had previously come under Ptolemaic control, dominion, Phoenicia, Judea, the Samaria, all of those areas, Idumea, now they're going to come under Seleucid control. And the Oneids, right, the priests, the Kohanim, they support, they throw their weight with the Seleucids originally. Okay, so now that means the Kohanim sort of have the upper hand. Vis-a-vis the pro-Greek kind of faction that's growing there. And with the help of Jewish scribes, the Seleucid king, his name is Antiochus, we're not yet up to the, you know, Antiochus, but Antiochus, he drew up a special charter. It was called the Charter of 200 for the ethnos of Judea, and he rewarded his supporters. The bottom line is it maintained that the Torah would continue to be the law of the land. And in fact, in that charter, it reflected some of the more spiritual concerns of the Tzedokim around the Beit HaMikdash. So it was at this time that it became sort of fixed. You know, that it was put in writing, you know, just how far Gentiles could go if they came to the Temple Mount, and, you know, where women could go and where the men, if they were in an impure state versus a pure state, where the Levim could go, where the Kohanim, like, all of that became sort of spelled out during that time. And it spells out the fact that Gentiles, non-Jews, are absolutely forbidden from entering into the temple precinct, okay? Just to give you an example of a well-known Jew from the time, Ben Sirach, I don't know if you've studied any of his writings in your classes, who was, you know, generally considered a pretty traditionalist. He deplored the materialism that was creeping into the city, right, as it's getting more wealthy. And of course, Greeks have a wonderful sense of aesthetics, and, you know, and artwork and beauty and all of that. So he kind of deplored that. Yet he admired the Greek education system. And the Jews then do something which we've done since time immemorial, which is that we borrow from the external culture to suit our own needs. And so that model of the gymnasium, the educational model, where when Greeks went to the gymnasium, they would learn Homer and Herodotus, and they would learn the sort of the Greek intellectual tradition. And so the Jews borrowed that model. And the idea was that this is, you know, that Jewish boys, you know, I hate to tell you, there wasn't a lot of education for girls at this time, but that Jewish boys then would go, and they would, you know, they weren't going to study Homer or something, but they would study the Torah, and they would study the you know, interpretations. And so that became something that the Jews going to school then became something that was an important part of Jewish education. Okay, and so sort of ultimately lays the foundation for, you know, yeshivas and schools all subsequently. Okay, but so that was kind of Ben Sirach was a little more conservative, so the idea was, okay, the Greeks have some good ideas, we'll borrow them in order to further our own way of life. Okay, now there were other Jews who weren't satisfied with this. They wanted to go further. Okay, so they were hoping, actually, they didn't want to sit and learn Torah all day. In fact, they wanted the Greek education. There were Jews who said, you know what, we want to learn Homer, we want to learn Herodotus. So they wanted really a Greek education, but they did not believe that that was incompatible with their Judaism. It wasn't that they were saying we want to become Greek and not Jewish, it's just that we're Jews, but we want to have a full Greek education. Anyway, trouble starts to brew then around the year 180. Okay, we're getting close, by the way, for those of you who are getting tired. 165 is kind of all where we have to get up to. By this time, the enthusiasm for the Seleucids was beginning to decline, and here's why. In the year 192, Antiochus III had suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of the Romans, and he was only allowed to keep his throne on the condition that he pay them very large sums of money. Well, Seleucus, I mean, this was, I'm sorry, this was Antiochus. You know, where do you think he's going to get the money? It's not as if he has a Swiss bank account, right? I mean, he's going to get the money from the different peoples that he has conquered. And so, you know, he looks, you know, Judah then is basically the bank of Judah, right? So he, and so he, you know, he and his successors, they were chronically short of money because they had to pay this sort of racket fee, as we could say, to the Romans. And basically, you know, the Seleucids felt that in that charter that had been established, one of the things they were supposed to do was to actually contribute, the Greeks, the Seleucids, were to contribute money to the Beit HaMikdash to pay for certain rituals. So he felt, right or wrong, that because he was supporting the temple, that the temple treasury was basically his own. You know, he was free to take from it when he needed it. Okay, so that's kind of where the problems are heading towards. So he dispatches his vizier to go to Jerusalem and to go take the money out of the Beit HaMikdash, out of the treasury. And he didn't really reckon, and it's one of the things that pagans kind of didn't really get, was just how sensitive the Jews would be about having, remember, about having somebody who's not Jewish, having a pagan going up onto the Temple Mount, violating the sanctity of the place. You know, on the one hand, in this case, like, he deliberately meant to take the money, but he didn't really appreciate just what a faux pas that was and how that was going to basically start a riot. Yeah?
Wasn't it that it was desecrated and that he, like, took a Torah scroll and, like, had relations on it or something?
Ooh, that's really bad. I think a little bit of that could be apocryphal, meaning, you know, I mean, you know, he wasn't like a sicko, you know, that's incredibly deviant behavior.
That is definitely what I learned in elementary school.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
May not have been him, but I
should. Okay. Yeah, no, so he was, at this point, it wasn't even Antiochus who went.
Okay.
Different pagan. That's a Roman, different culture. Roman, not Greek. But his big mistake was not appreciating that he was, by just going onto the Temple Mount, he was committing this great sort of crime against Jewish sensitivity. Okay, and so the Jews were essentially horror struck at this, and even Onias, who the Kohen Gadol, who had good relations with the Seleucids. I mean, he was horrified by this. And apparently, you know, there's you know, Josephus talks about, you know, like, you know, women kind of, I don't know, bawling their heads or running through the streets, young girls, like, you know, leaning out the windows, calling towards heaven. I mean, it's this great dramatic event. And it turns out the guy who'd gone to collect the money, he's actually struck by a stroke or something, and he's not able to even get the money. Yeah?
Was Antiochus aware of, like,
Yeah, because that was in the charter. On the other hand, it never applies to me. You know what I mean? Like, right, but I'm the king, and I'm sending my messenger to go get the money. Like, so we're not going there for ritual purposes. We're just going to get the money. So even though he was aware of it, he wasn't aware of the great sensitivity, meaning to another people, you could have gone to their temple and they would have said, hey, you're not supposed to come up here. But okay, you're here anyway, so let's show you around. You know, so it was the fact that kind of the Jews went ballistic that he didn't count on, that he didn't appreciate. He didn't appreciate that the sanctity really meant something. Okay, so anyway, this incident was really a milestone, because henceforth, any attack on the temple was likely to produce a riot. Okay, so, and of course, you know, nothing has really changed. Just try going on the Temple Mount today. Okay, but the crisis wasn't over, because remember the guy who had the stroke and wasn't able to get the money? So anyway, Onias, the Kohen Gadol, he has to then go to the Seleucids, who their palace is in Antioch at the moment. He has to go to him and try to smooth things over. And so while he's doing that, his brother Joshua, also known as Jason, I think he preferred his Greek name, he offered a bribe in the meantime. And see, here was the thing. Remember the Syrian, the Seleucids, because of this great tribute that they have to pay to the Romans, they are always short of cash. Okay, so they will take money from anybody. And what do they care who the Kohen Gadol is? So what happens is Jason then manages to send word that that he'll offer, you know, a lot of money if he could be the Kohen Gadol.
Instead of who?
Instead of his brother, Onias. And Antiochus is like, sure, okay, great, give me the money, you're the Kohen Gadol, it's fine. He didn't have a horse in that race, he didn't care. And Seleucus, by this time, the Seleucids agree, and Onias was basically forced to flee the court, and he's ultimately murdered. Now Jason, he was one of those people who wanted more Hellenism. He was kind of in favor of that. And the king at the time, Seleucus, he then is murdered by his own brother. And that's his brother Antiochus Epiphanes. That's kind of the famous one. So, and then Jason offers yet another bribe, which is to turn Jerusalem into a polis, to make it an official Greek city, okay? And if it's going to become a polis, then it's going to have all those elements that we saw already. So he offers the bribe, they take it, fine. But Jerusalem, though, cannot turn into a polis overnight, meaning you have to build the infrastructure and everything, but it's put into place that it will be on the way to becoming a polis. Okay, so all it took was a bribe, and so it would no longer be sort of a temple-centered nation-state, but it would be a Greek polis that was just like all the other Greek polis. And so a gymnasium was established in Jerusalem. That's one of the first things that was created. And it was provocatively close to the Beit HaMikdash. And it was a place where then young Jews could study Homer, Greek philosophy, and music, and they could compete in sporting events. Just one comment on how did they compete. So we do know that in some instances, in Greek records, they do record foreigners competing like in a loincloth as opposed to being, you know, in a birthday suit. So that's certainly possible that would have happened. The idea that you may have heard, what you may have heard when you were younger about, you know, Jewish men performing some kind of reverse circumcision on themselves, basically the surgery as this is described is simply impossible. Like it's most likely something like that never really happened. It was just a lot easier to put on a little loincloth, and then it's kind of a non-issue. Nobody has to see. Besides, they were all Jews, so it's not as if you were surprised that, you know, whether or not you looked a certain way. Okay, all right. Just getting back to that. And but until Jerusalem was a full-fledged polis, the Torah still remained the law of the land. Meaning, here's the thing. Once it becomes a polis, then the law of the land is not the Torah. The law of the land is Greek law. Okay, so that's kind of, it's not just we want a gymnasium. It's everything that comes along with that. And Jason's plans did receive a good deal of popular support during this first phase. And we hear of no opposition to the gymnasium in biblical sources. As soon as like the gong would sound for the athletic exercises, we know that the Kohanim used to hurry down from the Beit HaMikdash so that they could participate. Kohanim, landowners, merchants, yeah, there wasn't any, there wasn't an essential conflict with the gymnasium at this point. People, the Jews enjoyed participating in the challenges, I guess. And so they were all sort of, and another thing is, one of the reasons people may have been attracted to Hellenism and to the idea of a polis was that they thought it was ultimately it was going to be good for business, meaning it would mean that it would be a more open society and this would improve Jerusalem's economy. And so these people who were pushing for a more Greek acceptance, they did not believe that these were incompatible worlds. And they liked the Greek ideal sort of world citizenship, right? Of being somebody who's cosmopolitan, a citizen of the world. And when Antiochus Epiphanes visits Jerusalem in the year 172, he was actually given an enthusiastic welcome. Okay, we're getting close. 172, we gotta get to 165. Okay, but then the Hellenizers went too far. In 172, Menelaus bribed Antiochus when he went to pay the tribute. So that just shows you have to be careful who you give the tax money to, because they're walking with all this money to go pay it, and then when they get there, they may do other things besides just deliver the tax money. So he was sent to go deliver the tribute, the tax, and while he's there, he bribes Antiochus that he should become the Kohen Gadol instead of Jason, exactly. And Jason ends up fleeing because Antiochus, what is he, of course? He's short of what? He's short of money. And so, again, does he care who the Kohen Gadol is? Not at all. Fine, you want to pay me to be the Kohen Gadol? Great, you're the Kohen Gadol. He took the money, and now Menelaus, he gives Antiochus gives the stamp of approval, and now Menelaus is the Kohen Gadol. Now, Menelaus was, not only was he not a descendant of Tzadok, which was where the Kohen Gadol was supposed to come from, that lineage, there's pretty good evidence, according to the Book of Maccabees, he wasn't even a Kohen, and yet he was becoming the Kohen Gadol. Now, Josephus actually says he was a Kohen, so there's an argument back and forth. In both cases, they agree he had a brother named Shimon, Simon, but in one case, it's Shimon who is from a Kohen family, and in another case, it's a Shimon who's from, I think, the tribe of Benjamin or something like that. So it seems like, he certainly wasn't from the family of Tzadok, and good chance he wasn't even a Kohen. But now he's the Kohen Gadol, so I guess now he's Kohen. Anyway, the people then were becoming pretty disillusioned with this because they could see what was going on and that, that the Kohen Gadol had been reduced to something that was not so attractive. And then what happened was Jason tries to regain his position and Antiochus interprets this as a coup, as a rebellion. And so he uses that as a pretext to once again, Antiochus, is another Syrian king coming down to plunder the temple treasury. He storms into the temple itself. He removes then the altar, the lampstand, the veil of the dvir, and all the censers and vessels that he could get his hands on. Okay, so he violates obviously the Beit HaMikdash.
Why is he doing that?
Because when Jason decides to reassert and say he's the Kohen Gadol, he sees that as a provocation because he'd appointed Menelaus as the Kohen Gadol, and it's a good pretext to, just because the temple, remember, when we think of the Beit HaMikdash, we think of spirituality or, our relationship with God. But when other kings thought of the Beit HaMikdash, they thought of there's a lot of money there. There's a lot of silver. There's a lot of value. There's a lot of valuables. Okay, so that's what they wanted. So he wanted to get his hands on that. And so because of that, his violation of the sacred precinct, it doesn't cause the uprising quite yet, but the Jewish people, of course, don't forget that. And at that point, then, Antiochus becomes the archetype of the enemy of the Jewish people. Okay, so as a result of this, you know, his coming in, basically it puts an end to Jerusalem's development as a polis. And instead now it's being sort of reduced back just to a mere military colony ruled by Menelaus with the support of some kind of Assyrian garrison. But it's not sufficient yet to restore law and order. And in the next year, Antiochus sends another regiment because there's a lot of uprising going on. And it's then that he issues his decrees. First of all, he invades on Shabbat because he knows the law at that time was that the Jews did not fight on Shabbat. So he takes advantage of that. It will be the Maccabees who change that you can fight. First, you can fight in defense. Later on, of course, then you can fight, you know, even just to prepare yourselves for something. But anyway, so he invades on Shabbat, knows he's not going to have encounter any kind of opposition. He tears down part of the city walls. And then he builds this new fortress. It's called the Akra, A-K-R-A in English, overlooking the Beit HaMikdash. And this then becomes, it's like a garrison, and it becomes the Seleucid headquarters. Archaeologists have tried in vain to actually locate the precise location of it, and we still don't know where the Akra is. All we know is that it was, you know, pretty close to the Temple Mount. But so in effect, a separate district has been created, inhabited by pagan troops and Hellenistic Jews, where Greek gods were worshipped. But that's not all. Possibly at the behest of Menelaus and his supporters, Antiochus issued an edict which left an sort of indelible impression on the Jewish spirit and made it basically emotionally impossible for many Jews to accommodate then the Gentile world. Okay, basically what he did is he revoked that charter of 200, remember, which said that the Torah would continue as the law of the land, and instead he basically outlawed Judaism. Okay, so this is the first known real religious persecution in history, right? This you remember from when you were younger, that the temple liturgy was forbidden, Jews were not allowed to observe Shabbat, they were not allowed to observe Brit Milah. Yeah?
What was his motivation? Why would it help his cause to outlaw Judaism?
Okay, so some would argue that it was really at the behest of Menelaus, meaning that there was a certain segment of these very pro-Hellenistic Jews who wanted, basically, they, you know, their approach was, look, my fellow Jews, I have been patient with you. I have tried to reform you. I have tried to bring you along and make you more Greek. You, for whatever reason, you refuse to come along. I just can't deal with this anymore. So at this point now, I'm just going to force it down your throat. But because you're right, Antiochus, what motivation does he have? So it has to be something that it's actually, he's taking his cue from this faction inside of Jerusalem that has good access to him because it's this faction that's living in the Akra close with the Syrian garrison.
And they're telling him, we're sick of these people being too conservative.
Right, they're clinging to their, you know, old Near Eastern, their parochialism. And we need to, you know, we tried to bring them along. They just refuse. There's only one way to make this, you know, because they're still clinging to the idea that they want Jerusalem to be a polis. And there's only one way to do this, and that's to force them. And the way to force them is they're not allowed to be Jews anymore. That's basically it. And all of these things, if you violated these things, it was punishable by death. Okay, so it was pretty strict. So this was the first religious persecution, and once people started to die for the Torah, right, people start dying to preserve their Jewishness, it then becomes like even more sacred to Jews, right? So when they start seeing people being put to death because of this, that inspires other people. I mean, some people may just say, oh, forget it, all right, I'll do what you want. But there is going to be other people who are going to cling even more fiercely, more strongly. And as a result of this edict, though, the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, is transformed. Okay, and this is where the Hanukkah story is going to come into it. Antiochus, he broke down the gates and walls that had separated the sacred space from the rest of the city. and deliberately defying the prescriptions of the Torah. And remember, how does he even know what the prescriptions are in the Torah? He's obviously getting his information from, you know, the Hellenistic Jews. Yeah. He planted trees up on Harabite, right? You're not supposed to have trees up there. And transformed, essentially, the sacred space into a sort of a Greek-style sacred grove. The temple buildings, by this time, remember, there's nothing left to plunder because they'd been plundered already 2 years prior, so they were sort of left empty and desolate. And then it was on the 25th of Kislev, in the year 167, actually. I said 165 earlier, but I meant 167, that Jews learned, the words is sort of used, that there was some kind of abomination. Probably he put up some kind of a matzeva, we think. Some kind of standing stone had been set up next to the Mizbeach. And with its immense sort of what you have up there then on the Temple Mount is you have the trees, you have the Mizbeach, you have this matzeva. Somehow, he's basically turning it into it's almost like an old, like a bama of yesteryear, right? And so it could be also that what the Hellenized Jews thought that they were doing was that they were somehow going back to some kind of primordial Judaism, like somehow they were getting back to the Judaism of Avraham, you know, where worship took place on Bamot, as opposed to there wasn't a Beit HaMikdash during the time of Avraham. So they were somehow, you know, getting back to this pure distilled form of Judaism, and that the Temple Mount then is just dedicated to Olympios, or you know, the god on the high heaven, which again wouldn't necessarily be in conflict because that's a pretty good epithet for God anyway. But so they sort of thought that they were creating some kind of a rationalized cult that would appeal to all men of goodwill, to Greeks, to Jews. Yeah?
So the 25th of Kislev marks a day that the Greeks did something bad in the Beit HaMikdash?
Yeah.
Not when menorah was lit, or not when...
Well, that's in when 167. Yeah. No, because the menorah was lit 2 years later on the same day.
Oh, okay, same...
Okay, yeah.
Right, 167 comes before 165.
Yes. Right. Okay, yeah, because it's all BCE. Right.
I knew that, but like...
but all of these ideas were abhorrent to the Jews. Okay, and then just to conclude, so now you have the Temple Mount has been completely violated, okay? And the temple, the other thing to keep in mind is that the sacrifices now have been interrupted for the first time since the Second Temple had been rebuilt, obviously. Between the first and second Beit HaMikdash, there was an interruption. But since it had been rededicated in the year 515, the sacrifices have continued uninterrupted. So now there's no sacrifices that are going to go on for this 2 year period.
Not at all for 2 years.
Correct. Because the Jews don't have control. It's illegal to practice Judaism.
Since 167.
Yeah. And so while some opposed the Greeks, this became then a time of great sort of messianism and visions, and there was this notion, the whole concept of apocalypse, and became sort of filled the air, permeated the air. Other Jews decided, so some are opposed it that way, and others opposed it, thinking we've got to take up arms. And so after the Seleucid troops had taken up residence in the Acra and desecrated Har HaBayit, many Jews then felt they could no longer even live in Jerusalem. Like it had just been so, spoiled for them in that sense. And so they fled. And among these then was the Hashmonaim, okay? The family of the aged Kohen Matityahu and his five sons. So they end up, they were Kohanim, they'd been in Jerusalem, they end up leaving. In the book of Maccabees, it says how they fled to the hills and they left all their possessions behind and they had to eat, even wild plants and others followed. And then they sort of launched their own kind of religious campaign. They waged a religious campaign against Hellenized Jews where they would, if they found that there was a Jewish baby that didn't have a Brit Milah, they would do it. And so they sort of were forcing Judaism on Jews. Which, it always depends on your perspective, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So, and they overturned, you know, Greek altars wherever they found them. Anyway, of course, as you know, when Matsityahu died, he was succeeded by his son, Yehuda, nicknamed Maccabeus, hammerheaded, who took control, and he began to attack the Greeks and the Syrians. And here's the thing. See, the Seleucids were actually at this time very occupied. They were fighting in Mesopotamia because on the other side, there was a group of people known as the Parthians who had invaded part of Seleucid's territory. And so he had to be, they were very busy. They'd sent a good contingent of their army fighting there. So meanwhile, Judas, or Yehuda, his campaign had sort of unexpected success, really quickly too, you know, relatively. And so, yes, they were able to recapture the Har HaBayit, and I mean, you know the story. So, and ultimately, Antiochus is forced to rescind, you know, the infamous edict, and Judas and his family, the Hashmonaim, will gain control over Jerusalem. Although in the Acre, it will remain sort of this little enclave of Greeks and their Jewish sympathizers. Okay? So the Temple Mount is restored on the 25th of Kislev. It's actually, just to clarify...
By restored, you mean, like...
Rededicated.
Now it's not illegal to practice Judaism.
Right, and now rededicated, because it has to be cleaned up. And so it's actually not in 165. It's 3 years to the day of when it had first been violated, right? 25th Kislev, 167. So it's actually in 164. 3 years to the day that it has to be, you know, the trees have to be uprooted, it needs a major overhaul, in order to restore it, take away the statues and the matzevot and whatever is up there that shouldn't be up there. And I mean, the edifice hadn't been destroyed, meaning that, you know, the Syrians did not knock down the actual Beit HaMikdash. They just kind of, you know, changed, you know, they added things to it and had turned it into their own kind of a temple. But so then in the year 164, that's when we have the rededication, the Chanukat HaBayit. And interestingly, if you read, you know, everyone at some point should read the Book of Maccabees. It's probably in your Siddur. A lot of times it's in the Siddur, kind of in the back or something, or, you know, it's not hard to find. And they, when they rededicated it, it's interesting, they walked with palm branches. And the Hashmonaim, of course, they decreed the holiday of Hanukkah, and they made it 8 days. Now, according to the Book of Maccabees, obviously the Talmud gives a different interpretation, but according to the Book of Maccabees, the reason the holiday is 8 days is it's kind of observed like Sukkot, meaning they had missed Sukkot that year because of the fighting. And so that's what it says in the Book of Maccabees, that you have these 8 days because of Sukkot. And so, you know, it takes a while for the Hashmonaim to get established. It doesn't happen overnight also. But really, by around the year 161, Judas has managed to make some kind of agreement with Rome. And so he's going to use Rome, you know, Rome sort of will back him, because what you have at that time is you have the rising power of Rome, and you kind of have the diminishing power of the Greeks. And so the Seleucids, so he's going to play them off that way. All right, so that is by way of just a little historical background of how we got to where we got. But I realize it's not the 25th of Kislev, it's the 26th of Kislev, so we are one day off. But okay, thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions?
Thank you so much for coming.
When exactly did the Greek presence, military presence in Israel end? Did it not end until 161, or even then was it still around? Did it end right after the reconquering of Harbite, or was that just
Jerusalem? Yeah, so it really you know, it takes a while for it to get established, but ultimately it really takes about 20 years. It's really not until the 140s at some point where we now have an independent Hashmonaim, full sovereignty, complete political autonomy, which of course will last for a little while until, you know, the Romans come in. But yes, then you have a completely independent, politically independent Judah. But it does take about 20 years, actually.
And during that time, was the Charter 200 reestablished, or was it just that the religious restrictions were taken away, but they went back to paying taxes.
So it's a little bit confusing. Yeah, it gets taken away, but the Syrians are undergoing so much upheaval. And there's the other thing to keep in mind is there's a lot of infighting between them. And so at a certain point, they start competing with, among themselves, the Syrians start competing with favors that they start giving the Hashmonaim, meaning one leader of, you know, one potential king, because they're fighting each other. So let's just say one pretender to the throne says, okay, I'm going to appoint you the ethnos, you're going to be the leader of the community. And then another pretender of the throne will say, oh, but your brother will be the Kohen Gadol. You know, so they start kind of dishing out these favors. But basically, because the Seleucids, we caught them, the Hanukkah story was kind of fortuitous because we happened to catch them as they were slipping. Meaning, like, we came in and fought the Greeks as their power was going down. Which is, and so this becomes sort of the model, right? The Hanukkah story is the model for, like, a small, fervent Jewish people fighting the larger evil, you know. And it's a great paradigm. On the other hand, you know, it doesn't always play out with such favorable results. Meaning, okay, think about the first Roman revolt. Okay, we rebelled against Rome. You would think, and people were very much aware of the Hanukkah story. And that would be the paradigm. The problem was is that Rome dispatched probably the most able general they had, Vespasian. Okay, and so you know you had the full force of the Roman army that it was at the height of its power with an incredibly able, competent general who then ultimately becomes the emperor. But you know, so we kind of caught them at a bad moment. And then, again, we do it again with the second Jewish revolt, right? The Bar Kokhba campaign. Again, the model is Hanukkah. And again, it could be a small group of these ragtag brigands who are going to take down the mighty Roman Empire. And again, we didn't really time that quite so right because Rome was still pretty much at the height of its power. And Hadrian, I mean, they fought a good fight, don't get me wrong. But there was no way that they were going to defeat the entire Roman army. I mean, it just, and they were, and Hadrian was willing to use it if he had to. I mean, he was so irked. I mean, he wasn't going to let this get away. So that was, you know, you have to keep that in mind too. I mean, it was a great victory. I don't want to take anything away about it. But you know, the Syrians were, they were kind of, they weren't at their top of the game, shall we say? Yeah.
Is the story true? Wait, is the legend true that they used elephants? Growing up, that was always like a highlight of the Hanukkah story. Yeah, they said elephants, yeah, the Jews didn't know what to do with the elephants, they stuck a spear up.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's a historical fact.
Right, I'm trying to think. You know, certainly, they could have used elephants, sure. They're, in fact...
Wouldn't elephants have come from Egypt?
I'm trying to think, actually. I think there were elephants...
If they knew, like Persians from India could have brought elephants.
Yeah, but more likely, like, I mean, the classic example of using the elephants was Hannibal, right, who used the elephants against Rome. I'll have to look into that, actually. That, I, you know, whether the Seleucids were using, I mean, basically the elephants were like tanks. That's kind of how they were used. I'll have to look into that. I can't answer you that. But that's a good question. I like that. Now I'll have something to pursue when I get home tonight. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I mean, I could make something up, but
it's important to think of all the things you learned when you were younger and figure out if they fit into the historical.
Yeah, and a lot of times there is sort of a kernel to it, you know. Okay, well, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your holiday.
Take like 20 donuts each.
Yeah, take 20 donuts each.